The next phase of testing for COVID-19 will be testing to see if people have antibodies for the virus. But some scientists are saying slow down.
Without appropriate guidance, these tests could be used in, quite frankly, harmful ways.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation about serum testing for the coronavirus. We'll also learn how a reporting error is hurting students' credit scores and spend an academic minute with platinum cancer drugs. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Testing for COVID-19 is still a hot topic in the news, as well as the medical community. Initially, testing for viral RNA was instituted to detect presence of the virus itself. But now that a growing percentage of the population has been exposed to the novel coronavirus, there have been calls for more serum or blood measurements of antibodies to the virus. In record time, both commercial and laboratory-developed serology tests for these antibodies have flooded the market. They've gained a lot of attention, as well as generated criticism in both the scientific community and the media. This brings us to a cautionary opinion piece on the current situation entitled SARS-CoV-2 Serology, Much Hype, Little Data, by Drs. Christopher Farnsworth and Neil Anderson from the Washington University School of Medicine and Barnes Jewish Hospital. The paper is available online now and will appear in the July 2020 print edition of the journal Clinical Chemistry, and both doctors are with us to talk about this paper. First, Dr. Farnsworth, what is the purpose of serology testing for COVID-19?
Yeah, so there have really been three proposed uses for serologic testing. The first is for diagnosing patients with active infection, and this is generally discouraged given the superior performance of molecular testing early in disease. However, the Infectious Disease Society of America recently released guidelines that serologic testing may be useful in a niche group of individuals that present later with onset of symptoms consistent with COVID, but are negative by molecular testing. The second is identifying convalescent plasma donors that were previously infected but have recovered and now have high titers of potentially neutralizing antibodies. The third is for population screening. And within this group, there are really two subgroups: those that want to screen the population to determine who's protected and can go back to work, and those that want to do epidemiologic studies to determine the true prevalence of COVID-19 in the population.
And Dr. Anderson, we'll go to you now. What types of serologic assays are available for COVID-19 testing, and what's known about their performance?
So there's quite a few assays available. Currently, there's greater than 100 serologic assays available for the detection of antibodies against SARS-CoV-2. They come in a wide variety of formats. Some detect IgG, some detect IgM, and some detect IgA. They have also been designed to perform in a variety of different settings. Some can be ran in point of care, whereas others are made to be run in very large batches on large in-lab analyzers. One of the reasons why there is such a wide variety of serologic tests available is the approach the FDA took to their regulation. In order to make the testing more available, the FDA actually removed requirements for FDA review of SARS coronavirus 2 serologic assays. So this has actually been a double-edged sword. While serology assays are certainly more available, since many of them have not been properly vetted, they have quite variable performance. Some have decent performance, whereas some are actually quite inaccurate. If these assays are widely deployed, particularly inaccurate ones, they can have very negative consequences for public health. One area in which these inaccuracies can become downright dangerous, actually, is when serologic assays are relied upon for diagnosis. In fact, I would argue solely relying on COVID-19 serology for diagnosis of acute infection is always a risky proposition, even for some of the better assays. One reason for this is that antibody response to SARS coronavirus 2 takes up to 2 weeks to develop, so patients will often have falsely negative results early in infection. Data from our institution actually shows that IgG testing has a sensitivity of less than 10% within 3 days of symptomatology and less than 44% at less than 14 days. False positives are also quite a big issue with these assays. Many of them have cross-reactivity to antibodies against common circulating pathogens, such as seasonal coronaviruses. Patients with seasonal coronaviruses may present in a similar way to those with SARS coronavirus 2, so this prospect of a false positive result is way more than just a theoretical risk. The bottom line here is that patients and providers should avoid using serology alone to diagnose SARS coronavirus 2. Molecular techniques are far more accurate in patients with acute disease. If serology is used as an adjunct, it needs to be interpreted with extreme caution.
We've now heard how such serologic testing has helped better define prevalence in places such as New York City. This has revealed a much larger number of previously unknown infected individuals than anticipated. So shouldn't we be doing this throughout the country as soon as possible?
Yeah, so one of the advantages of serologic testing is it can help determine previous exposure to a virus. So it may have utility in epidemiologic studies that are trying to define the prevalence in a population. However, we do have some concerns about the studies that have been mentioned in the press. The primary issues are prevalence of the disease and the specificity of the laboratory tests that are being used. One of the basic laboratory medicine principles that we teach our residents is that when you are screening a population with a low prevalence of disease, the screening method must have a low false positive rate, also known as a high specificity. If 1% of the population has the disease, even a test with a high specificity, say 98%, would potentially give you one false positive result for every true positive if you screened everyone. As a result, a study that used this test could claim a prevalence that's 2 times higher than the actual true prevalence. We actually outlined this concept in our paper using New York City as an example. In New York, the estimated prevalence based on molecular testing is about 1.69% of about 8.5 million people. Therefore, if a serologic test has a specificity of 99.5%, the positive predictive value, or ratio of true positives to false positives, is about 75%, where 3 in 4 positives will be true positives. However, if the specificity is lowered to 98%, the positive predictive value plummets to 45%, or 1 in 2 positive results is a false positive. Our institution is actually based in Missouri, where the prevalence of COVID infections is likely tenfold lower at least than New York City. Again, just using simple math, we see that in our population, even a serologic test with a specificity of 99.5% will only give us a true positive 16% of the time, meaning that in low-prevalent cities and states, which is likely most of the country at this point, screening the entire population is likely to result in a considerable number of false positive results and give people that were never exposed to the virus a false sense of protection from future infections.
Well, since we're all eager to end the social distancing, should everyone get a serology test to confirm whether or not they're immune?
So the desire to identify those who are immune to SARS coronavirus 2 is one of the applications of serologic testing that has gained very much attention in the lay press and has garnered a lot of excitement from the general public. While this is quite understandable, it's based on a misconception that serologic positivity means immunity. There currently are no serologic assays available that can reliably predict immunity to SARS coronavirus 2. Currently available assays are designed to detect past exposure to SARS coronavirus 2. Many infer that this past exposure equates to future immunity, though the fact of the matter is that we simply don't know if this is true. In order to answer this question definitively, we need prospective outcome data, which is still lacking given how relatively new this pathogen is. Those looking for an antibody test to give them a peace of mind about their immune status should really keep appropriately tempered expectations. They may have had the disease and test falsely negative, or they may have never had the disease and test falsely positive. In fact, those looking for peace of mind may find the opposite, particularly if they're relying on a bad test.
Well, finally, doctors, what steps should laboratory experts take to responsibly offer serologic testing to their patient populations?
So this is a really important question, and where we as a laboratory community have an opportunity to provide expertise, especially since a large proportion of these tests have not gone through the emergency use authorization process and have not been truly vetted by the manufacturer or by independent labs. But it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. The validation that you perform will really depend almost entirely on how you plan to use the test. As a generalization, when we validate a lab test, we'll analyze a minimum of 50 positive samples from patients with PCR-confirmed infection. For negative samples, using specimens that have been frozen prior to the emergence of SARS-CoV-2 is a common approach. We also have used samples from patients that have COVID-like symptoms but are negative by molecular testing. We also recommend that labs use specimens from patients with other confirmed seasonal coronaviruses, the flu, and other viruses like EBV and CMV to assess cross-reactivity. The number of negative specimens that you analyze is entirely dependent, though, on how you plan to use the test. Again, if used for screening in a likely low-prevalence community, a high specificity and considerable confidence in that specificity is a must, especially for tests that have not been formally validated. This will require hundreds to potentially thousands of negative specimens to truly understand how the test performs. In contrast, if your facility is using serologic testing to aid in diagnosis, knowing how many days post-symptom onset your patient population becomes positive is key, and far more positive patients will become necessary. Finally, if you plan to use your assay for determining antibody titers in convalescent plasma donors, it's important that you validate your test for this use.
Another important aspect to consider prior to implementation of SARS coronavirus 2 serology testing is education. Given all the hype and misconceptions about SARS coronavirus 2 serology testing, even the most knowledgeable providers may be misinformed. Prior to offering serologic testing, laboratory experts really should discuss with their providers exactly how the testing should be utilized in their setting and what needs to be done to prevent misuse. Efforts to educate ordering providers should be made, which may range from educational CME presentations all the way to electronic clinical decision support. Finally, laboratory experts should be prepared to perhaps step outside their hospital walls and their comfort zones to engage in local and national testing policies. The drive for COVID serology is very real, and there's a real chance that without appropriate guidance, these tests could be used in, quite frankly, harmful ways. Laboratory experts can only prevent this by acknowledging the hype, educating about the perils, and guiding the way forward in the way we were all trained to, by using an evidence and data-based approach.
That was Dr. Neil Anderson, and he was joined by Dr. Christopher Farnsworth. They are both from the Department of Pathology and Immunology at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. Their opinion piece, entitled SARS-CoV-2 Serology, Much Hype, Little Data, is available online now and appears in the July 2020 print edition of the journal Clinical Chemistry. The CARES Act, passed by Congress in March, effectively postponed student federal loan payments through September in light of the economic crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic. But some borrowers say their credit scores have taken a hit as a result. The best of our knowledge is Jesse King reports.
29-year-old Andrew Dellinger says he has been particularly on top of his weekly Credit Karma reports lately. He and his wife plan to buy their first home in Wisconsin in a few months, so he was shocked when he suddenly got an email saying his Equifax score dropped 53 points last week.
There was a remark on my account, and the remark had said that my loans had been put into deferment. I'm paid ahead through October, actually, and I have it auto-paid set to pay beyond the minimum amount required. So the irony of it is pretty stark.
Dellinger says the remark on his federal student loans with servicing company Great Lakes was the only change to his account. Then Dellinger did what many people would do in a similar situation. He took the matter to Facebook and found some of his friends had experienced the same thing. 26-year-old Paul Hoteling of Utica is over 6 months ahead on his student loan payments, but both his Equifax and TransUnion scores dropped about 20 points, seemingly after his automatic April payment was set aside by the CARES Act.
Probably closer to the average based on what I've seen, like on Twitter and what people were talking about. It seems to be 20 to 30 is about the average. But again, you know, that can swing pretty wildly, I guess.
Hotelling has been researching the claims online ever since. But aside from personal accounts on social media and the occasional report by a local news outlet, information has been hard to come by, making for a rather confusing few days. Great Lakes appears to be the only loan servicer mentioned so far, with some borrowers reporting a range of dropped scores and others seeing no negative change at all. When the CARES Act passed in March, Great Lakes notified customers that it was moving accounts, even those with autopay, into administrative forbearance through September. Borrowers could contact Great Lakes to opt out of forbearance and continue making payments if they wanted. But Section 3513 of the CARES Act explicitly states that the Department of Education and its servicers must report suspended payments to credit reporting agencies as if nothing is wrong, as if they are regular, scheduled payments. Again, here's Dellinger.
So clearly this is an error on the part of Great Lakes and how they're reporting it. What are they going to do to resolve it?
Great Lakes didn't respond to multiple calls seeking comment, and the U.S. Department of Education did not respond in time for broadcast. In a social media post late last week, Great Lakes appeared to distance itself from the situation, writing, quote, "We're working with credit reporting agencies to ensure the accuracy of the information we reported regarding COVID-19 forbearances, and we do not believe our reporting has impacted actual consumer credit scores provided by those agencies. We recommend contacting credit reporting agencies directly to obtain your actual credit score and credit report, rather than relying on information from third-party services, which often use different formulas," end quote. When he called the servicer himself, however, Hotelling says he got a different answer.
They said that the way that they're going to go about fixing it is the remark's going to remain throughout April, and then they'll fix it for May going forward and retroactively change April, but they only fix things on a month-end basis. So I guess they expect people to just kind of, you know, live with this for a month.
Dellinger says he was told the same thing, easing fears for the time being despite the wait. But William Riccardi, assistant professor at the University at Albany School of Business, says it may not be that easy. He says Great Lakes is basically just the messenger. While it may retroactively fix the mark on its end, that doesn't necessarily mean the credit reporting agencies will budge.
There might be no problem. The credit reporting agency might update it, or they might not. And if they don't update it, at that point, Great Lakes has done everything that they're supposed to do. And it's very, very difficult to get in contact with somebody at the credit reporting agencies to explain the situation to a person and tell them, look, this is what happened. The lender fixed it, but it's still in my credit report. What do I do?
Recounting his own experience a few years ago, Riccardi says it took several months for one of the agencies to fix an error on his report, even with two separate letters from the lender taking full responsibility for the mistake. Riccardi guesses that, given the quick turnaround of the CARES Act, the recent discrepancies could be the result of a simple technological error at Great Lakes. But he also notes that the calculations behind our credit scores and the machinations of credit reporting agencies are rarely transparent, and therefore it's often hard to determine who's at fault in these situations. Luckily, Dellinger says he's in a good place financially at the moment, and he is putting his home search on hold until his score is corrected. But he feels bad for people who may be seeking additional funding, especially right now. The pure confusion and lack of communication, he says, has been the most frustrating.
I want a practical solution for this, and I want the person who's accountable for it to own it and say, hey, we're sorry that we did this. This is really unfortunate. Let's correct it. It's a simple thing that people are asking for here. Own it and fix it.
After calling Great Lakes again, Dellinger says the servicer acknowledged the reporting error and said it would expedite its correction process in light of his housing plans. In response to complaints online, Great Lakes has typically written back, quote, if you believe our reporting is inaccurate or has negatively impacted your score, please give us a call at 800-236-4300, end quote. I'm Jesse King.
Still to come, a book for young people combines screen time and getting the heck out of the house. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them all online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. Thank you. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. So it's not like young people were getting too little screen time before the COVID-19 pandemic. A combination of at-home learning and sheer boredom has increased that time a lot. There is a book that combines screen time with reading and listening skills for young children and might even inspire them to go outside. It's called Sounds of the Night, and it's available both as a download from Apple Books and as a regular hard copy book. It features nature nighttime sounds and breaks them down with pictures to help young readers and listeners identify the animals making the sounds. It's the brainchild of Brent Ford, founder and CEO at Envision Ideas.
I grew up hearing these nightly sounds for years and years, and you hear people talk about what makes those sounds. Is it a frog? Is it a cricket? And I decided to write a book and answer a lot of those questions for kids, and then hope that they would then have an interest and want to answer questions of their own.
You start the book out with just a cacophony of nighttime sounds that you might see in a field anywhere in the U.S. Where did you record that, and how did you break that down afterwards?
Well, so actually, I didn't record that myself. That was a sound that I found online. There's amazing amount of material online, and so it was something that I picked up, and then you have to break it apart, and you look at what kinds of animals live in what parts of the country, and then figure out what's making that sound. You know, the point of the book was not to help kids really identify the sounds or memorize what's making the sounds. It was the fact that animals make a lot of sounds at night. And that leads to bigger questions about why would they do that? Why would it be noisier at night than during the day? Those are the kinds of questions that we really want kids to think about and try to answer for themselves.
There really is some stunning photography in the book, too.
There is. And again, those are not my photographs. Those were things that I was able to access online. It was fun to find out what was available and how to relatively easily create this book. I have to say that it was relatively easy to put these pieces together, but it's all in service to a bigger idea and a bigger project, and that's really what we're all about is getting to those bigger ideas.
Now, the book is available, of course, for iPads, and I read it on my iPhone. Are there hard copies of this available?
There are. We started with the iPad because it's so easy to be able to marry the audio with the images, and then there's also videos in some of the extension activities, so it's easy to put it all together. But there's some research in the world that says that a physical book may benefit a young child more so than a digital book, and so we did create a physical book, and we used QR codes to link either a phone, a tablet, with the audio and with the other video enhancements, so that, you know, we imagine that a parent would sit with their child, they'd look at the pictures, they would then access the tech features together, and that would then spur more conversation between the parent and the child.
After you break down all of the sounds of the night and with their individual components and creatures, there's some more lessons. And one that I didn't expect, I thought was kind of cool, was perspective in photography. I like that. Why'd that come in?
When you go through the book, there are, at least in the southern part of the United States and the eastern part of the United States, there are a lot of sounds that are made by frogs. And I had run across this picture of a frog that is small enough to fit in the palm of your hand. And that's actually one of the frogs that's making those sounds. And you think, wow, that little animal can make a really big sound in the night. Well, what are the other frogs look like that are making the other sounds that we hear? And so there is a way that kids can look at relative sizes of these frogs that are making these sounds. And they're fit in the palm of your hand to some very large frogs. I mean, the bullfrog, for instance, in this part of the country won't fit in the palm of your hand. It's a very big frog. So it was let's look at other things and again, think about the variation that we see across the animal kingdom That's one of the most interesting things that we can kind of impart to kids, is that we see frogs of all different sizes. How do they live? Where do they live? Why did they develop in the way that they developed? Those are the questions, again, that we want kids to think about.
The name of Brent Ford's book is Sounds of the Night, a child's interactive book of fun and learning. Don't look now, but some cancer drugs have gone platinum. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Platinum isn't just for well-selling music artists. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Rob Bachman, professor of chemistry, explores a benefit of this precious metal.
People generally don't think about platinum playing a role in stopping cancer, but it does, courtesy of an unexpected discovery in the 1960s. Barnett Rosenberg was exploring whether electrical fields might play a role in cell division. Luckily for us, he chose platinum electrodes for these experiments, a choice that led to an astonishing discovery. The electrodes were generating small amounts of platinum-centered molecules that cause unusual cell division, suggesting that they might stop cancer in its tracks. After 15 years of research by many teams of scientists, one of these molecules made it to clinical use, a drug called cisplatin. Cisplatin is successfully used for many types of cancer, but often has devastating side effects. Since then, my group and many others have designed new platinum-centered molecules that aim to keep cisplatin's cancer-killing behavior while removing its side effects. In my mind, synthetic chemistry is naturally intertwined with art, especially sculpture. The novel molecules we design and create must have the correct shape to interact with the natural world as desired. Listening to others at a conference, this inspired me to sketch several new drug designs. My approach was a bit like Lego building without directions, interchanging available building blocks to achieve a goal. Numerous undergraduates working with me in my teaching and research laboratories have crafted many new molecules in the hope of creating better anti-cancer drugs. So far, our work has generated interesting new sculptures with unique chemical reactivity and biological behavior similar to a critical step of cisplatin's cancer-killing action. We know there are still many steps along the road to the ultimate goal, and that potential medicines often don't work well enough for clinical use. Thus, the overarching goals of this work are simultaneously improving human health and growing the next generation of scientists.
That was Rob Bachman of the University of the South. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.